Case number 06-5173. Patricia L. Sims, appellant versus Stephen L. Johnson, administrator, United States Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Terrence for the appellant, Mr. Smith for the appellee.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
I'd like to begin by addressing the jurisdictional issue which the court postponed on defendant's motion to dismiss. There's no question that we filed within the 60 days from the denial of our motion for declaratory judgment. The only possible question is whether the case had there been a final judgment issued several years before. And we submit, Your Honors, that there is absolutely nothing in the record that even looks like a final judgment, let alone satisfies Rules 58 and 79. The district court said that they did not point to any specific document that it said was a final judgment. It said that the combination of an interaction between four different documents somehow ended up in being a final judgment. I submit that there's no possible way to make that consistent with the federal rules and perhaps even more clearly with the Supreme Court's decision in Bankers Trust, in which the Supreme Court made very clear that these rules, the 58 and 79, were to be mechanically applied. They were to be technically applied. It was to be clear that there was a document, there was a judgment, that the 60 days began to run, and therefore the party would know quite clearly that if it wanted to appeal, that it had to do so.
All right.
None of the documents that were part of this interaction and combination had looked like a final judgment, let alone being having been stated to be one.
This is not jurisdictional, but it may be res judicata-ish. Okay.
It may be what, Your Honor?
Res judicata-ish. The February 28th, 2003 decision by Magistrate Judge Kay.
Yes.
Where he rules that the motion for attorney's fees and costs is denied as moot.
Correct.
Did you agree that it was moot at the time?
Your Honor, unfortunately, there isn't a transcript of it.
Well, what's your position? I mean, are you representing?
Our position is actually, if you look very carefully at that,
yeah,
that what it actually says is there was an agreement between the government and the former counsel.
Yeah.
Not present counsel. That
were
was
you part of the phone call?
Excuse me?
Were you
yes,
part of
I was. I was on the phone call, Your Honor. And then if you see later on in that same document that the cost of the defendant.
I understand that. I want to get more toward the bottom line here. So a motion for attorney's fees and costs was filed, correct?
That's correct.
And it was filed with the approval of the client, I take it?
That is correct in the sense that is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
And so regardless of what actually happened during the phone call, or regardless of what actually happened or what representations were made, at the end of that time, at the end of the process, the magistrate judge ruled that the motion for attorney's fees and costs both was moot and therefore denied it, right? Now, it seems like, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but it seems like you're suggesting that that was wrong, that it wasn't moot, that you agreed on the costs, but you didn't agree on the fees.
Well, no, let me be clear. I think that is true reading the order as it is stated. But let me be absolutely clear. We don't, even if we're wrong on that, and that what was decided then was that the amount of the fees was not under challenge any further after that time. there is still nothing in that that says that there shall be payment of a specific amount of fees that the court had decided should be done. Or is there any other document that there had been an agreement as to a specific amount?
Leaving aside the agreement just for the moment, the motion for the fees, did it specify an amount?
Yes, Your Honor.
It did. So
yes, it did.
The judge ruled that that was moot.
That's correct.
So if you disagree, leave aside the issue of who it was to, who the payment had to be to, but as to the amount, if you disagreed that it was moot, wouldn't you have asked either the magistrate to reconsider it or asked the district court to review the magistrate's decision?
There is no time after that that there was a dispute as to the amount of fees. So I am not representing to Your Honor that there was a dispute as to fees and that remained open.
So what, the only issues to the only issue then is who the check was made out to?
No, the issue that came up, of course, as I'm sure
it's
Your Honor is aware,
is
the problem of taxation.
Right. Now, I'm aware of that, but is there an issue with who the check was made out to, or was the check made out to the right person?
That has never been in dispute.
Okay, so.
And let me explain
why that is. So there's no dispute.
Let me just say
no dispute as to the amount, and there's no dispute as to who the check was made out to. Is that correct?
There's no dispute in the sense that it had never been raised who it was going to be made out to. In other words, that was not part of that. That did not underlie that ruling of Judge Kaye.
Who was the check made out to?
Who was it ultimately made out to?
Yeah.
It was made out to counsel.
To counsel as
former counsel,
right? As fiduciary for the client, or just period to the counsel?
Just to counsel, and the reason why there was never a dispute about who was to be made out to, because my client's only problem was not about the amount. Right. My client's problem was, of course, the tax consequences, and the tax consequences would not have been affected, at least that's our view, that would not have been affected by who the check was made out to.
Okay, so that's not an issue. The only issue then is the timing of the check, and you say that you have a right to prevent the government from sending a check that's required by a court order?
There is no such court order, Your Honor.
Or pursuant to the settlement, which the court then recognized made the motion moot.
But that is not the equivalent of a court.
Put aside the court order, but pursuant to a settlement that caused the magistrate judge to dismiss the motion as moot. You're saying the government, that you have a right to prevent the government from sending a check that's been part of a settlement?
Yes, Your Honor, I do insist on that. And I think what Jeff D. makes holds, and what this court's decision in Moore holds, that the total control over attorney's fees is in the client. That is the holding of the Supreme Court. It's the holding of Moore. It's the holding of
That's just between the client and the client's attorney. That's not in preventing a check being sent pursuant to a judgment or pursuant to a settlement from the other side. That has nothing to do with that.
Your Honor, if there was a court order, the posture would be different.
It was a settlement that was embodied in a court order.
But it's a settlement. Let's be clear who the settlement was between. If the settlement is between the government and former counsel,
you've already said you don't care who the check was made out to or the amount, that there's no dispute about either of those two issues. So that, I mean, I don't know what's left.
What's left is sending the check, Your Honor.
No, but let me ask you. The magistrate says a settlement was reached. He never says what the settlement was.
Exactly, Your Honor.
All right, and we don't know from this record what the settlement was.
That is correct.
So to the extent there is a motion for fees in the amount of X, and everybody agrees X should be paid, that is moot. And at least one way of reading the record is to say that is what the magistrate was saying.
That is a way to read, but what was not settled there and was not moot because it was not at issue, and the magistrate's ruling does not even suggest that it was at issue, was that there actually be payment. And there, Your Honors, there was no payment.
All right,
for 2 years. So if there had been, if this was something that had to be paid,
why is that, by the way?
Why was there no payment?
Yeah.
Well, for a considerable period of time, there was no action at all.
I know why.
I don't know why there was no action.
Well, that's the other side.
In other words, the government didn't take any action, and if the government thought that it was under some obligation for it, I think the one has to, I can't prove this, but I think one has to assume the government did not think it was under any actual obligation.
All right, but could I go, now the district court comes along and says, she reopened the case for a limited purpose, all right, and there was never any mention of the client's concern about tax consequences. And this
well,
is all.
There was nothing reopened after this point on any subject until the motion. There was a, you know, some little of any substance until the motion for declaratory judgment.
What I'm trying to understand, though, is the district court denied that motion, correct?
The motion for declaratory judgment.
Yes.
That's correct. That's what's before your honors.
And denied it, at least in part, on the grounds that when she originally dismissed the case and then she reopened it, it was reopened for a limited purpose. And that there was never any indication about a concern regarding tax consequences, and that this notion is something that is new.
Well, Your Honor, because it's new only in the sense that it was reopened over the question of attorney's fees, and it's tied to attorney's fees. It's the issue of tax consequences is part of the same issue, which is the attorney's fees.
I'm trying to understand, Mr. Terrace, is the district court, as I read the opinions, takes the view that it was clear attorney's fees were owed.
And so ruled,
and that there were some figures to be determined.
Excuse me?
There were some amounts to be determined.
Correct.
And then those amounts were determined by the parties.
That's Judge Kaye's order.
And from the district court's perspective, that's the end of the case.
Well, if we're talking jurisdiction here, that's not the end of the case.
No, we moved
beyond.
Okay,
so we're not okay.
We're into the merits.
Okay.
Yes.
That is the end. Okay, I agree with Your Honor that the district court undoubtedly thought at that point it was the end of the case. There had been no payment, and what happened then was the government started negotiations with former counsel about making the payment. At that point, present counsel, myself, strenuously objected that there was a tax consequence here that needed to be worked out.
And on what basis does the fact of tax consequences give you a right to prevent the check from being sent?
Because under Jeff D., we have the right to prevent the check from being sent for any reason.
You have the right to waive your fees.
Exactly. We could have simply said,
now you might
we're
still,
angry at former counsel.
So you might still be sued by the other counsel for having worked on the case for a long time and for getting nothing.
Precisely.
In which case, you would probably lose some money unless you could show that they committed malpractice or something. But that's between the two of you.
Correct.
And the question you're asking is, as far as the government is concerned, the only relationship is with the plaintiff. There's no independent relationship with the lawyer.
Precisely.
Let me ask you, in your experience in these matters, normally when there is a agreement regarding fees and a payment, is the payment, as it is here, written to a lawyer? Is it written to the lawyer as fiduciary for? Is it sent to the lawyer in a fiduciary account in which the lawyer has to deposit fees? How is this normally done? Do you know?
Normally, the payment comes to us. To the lawyer.
And the issue of what that means, that is whether it's for the benefit of the client or not, is between the client and the lawyer.
That's great. I may say to Your Honor,
and
this is not in the record, but when Jeff T. came down, we changed our retainer agreements, and we put into the retainer agreement that if the client interfered with our getting fees, the client became liable for our fees. So there are ways to handle the Jeff T problem, or as Judge Garland, you have suggested, even without such a provision, there may very well be a possible suit. But the basic proposition that I am arguing, and I think Jeff T. is clear, that to the very end, to the point of payment, the control is in the client, and for any reason, and no reason, the client can simply say, no, here, what would have happened in the record, I think,
But here, there had already been an agreement, and the court had already entered an order reflecting that agreement. Doesn't that make it a different case?
But there's no order. There was no order for payment. There was an order as to the amount of money that was the appropriate amount of attorney's fees between that the government would have to pay. But before payment was done, the government was told.
I thought you said there's no dispute about the amount.
I just said that, Your Honor. Right. I'm saying that there was not a dispute about the amount, but there was nothing in Judge Kaye's order or in any other document that indicates that the government was required to pay X amount of money by such and such a time.
Proceeding here, back to the jurisdictional issue for a minute, are you proceeding here under Title VII or under an argument about the settlement agreement? That is your entitlement to the fees here?
It was under Title VII of the Rehabilitation Act,
and not as part of the as part of an agreement.
Part of,
and not
well,
as
the agreement was based on the
on Title VII
on Title VII of the Rehabilitation Act, and then the agreement, Your Honor, was not an agreement as to a particular amount. It was an agreement that what it said is the government was liable for the fees, which is a customary.
That's the letter agreement you're talking about.
The letter agreement I'm talking about, yes. And that's customary in these kinds of cases to bifurcate, first deciding liability and then deciding the amount.
What was in JA 88, there's a letter from you to Mr. Swick where you say the merits of the case have not been resolved.
Well,
about? That strikes me as questionable.
Well, let me explain it. The basic merits had been resolved through the letter agreement, which was enforced. However, at that time, the court itself said there were a few loose ends we still have to deal with. They never were dealt with. Later on, there were problems of enforcement that my client had, and so I had written to the government. Merits in that sense, not in the sense of merits deciding the original case, but on how the letter agreement was being carried out.
Wasn't written with an eye toward the tax consequences?
No. And, Your Honor, the tax consequences problem, by the way, I should say this, has arisen in the period in the last few years.
It's the 2004 Act.
So that's why it had not been brought up earlier at the time of the enforcement proceedings in 2000, et cetera. It's a more recent development of the law.
Would you like to save your time?
I would, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for Appley.
May it please the court, Peter Smith for the Appley, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I would like to start with the discussion about the magistrate judge's 2003 decision and then go back to some of the broader issues that I had planned to talk about. I would like to focus the court's attention on the joint appendix at pages 60 to 61. The panel was exactly right that after Judge Kaye rendered his decision finding the amended motion for costs and fees moot, that appellant did not ask for review, nor did she ask the district court to vacate that order. Mr. Terrace had stated to the panel that the issue was never raised as to whom payment would be made or the amount of that payment. There is a history behind the telephonic hearing in 2003. And if you look at the Joint Appendix at 60 and 61, it will become clear to you what was going on.
Well, let me ask you, that language on 61 is the first attorney, first assistant U.S. attorney speaking, Mr. Harris, is it not?
Well.
And he acknowledges the control of a client. Then we have a new assistant U.S. attorney later on who's involved in the actual payment.
That's correct. There actually were three assistant U.S. attorneys involved during the period between 2000 and the present.
Well, that statement on page 61, and in seeking attorney's fees, the attorney's fees have to be awarded to the plaintiff, not to the counsel.
That's the government.
That's Mr. Terris, isn't it?
That's
no, that's Mr. Harris.
Well, what I'm looking at on Joint Appendix 61.
Looks 60, like it's Mr. Terris.
Oh, Mr. Terris.
Right. Well, if you look at the top of page 61, the statement that I wanted to point out is Mr. Terris. It's continuing from the page before, page 60, and he says, we are in agreement to have Mr. Shapiro continue to represent the plaintiff in the submission of the fee request.
Right. It's the sentence before that I'm interested
right.
in.
Right.
And I think, obviously, Judge Rogers is. The one that says, and in seeking attorney's fees, the attorney's fees have to be awarded to plaintiff, not to counsel.
And that's Mr. Terris speaking. And
yes.
then he says, for those purposes, you should be communicating with Mr. Shapiro.
Right. For the purpose of the amount, but not on the question of who it is to be awarded to. Is there any place where you can show us the plaintiff or the plaintiff's then lawyer, that is the lawyer actually operating at the time, saying that they agree that the money should be paid to the former counsel?
I think that this colloquy here, if you continue to read, does reflect that sort of instruction. Regardless, in 2003, all of the counsel, as Judge Kavanaugh pointed out with respect to Mr. Terris, all of the counsel were on the phone with the magistrate judge, and the fee petition was rendered moot, was decided to be moot.
I know, but the problem is with this record, candidly, counsel, you may be entirely correct, but we just don't know, because the magistrate says there's been an agreement, but we don't know what the agreement is.
Well, the agreement mooted out the fee petition. We know that.
No, but it may have been that there was an agreement as to the amount, so that's moot. But there are some other issues. That's what we don't know.
Well, I don't believe there are other issues, but if you look at at the appellant's papers, he talks about some other issues. And now, again, I wasn't the assistant U.S. attorney on the case at the time. I can tell you what my understanding of what happened was.
But is your understanding what happened based on a record that's in front of us? On some document that we can look at?
Well, the record, I think that it's correct. There is no document. There's nothing in the record about this. There is in the transcript that I was pointing the court to a statement that maybe there are some issues, but the plaintiff appellant never pursued any of those. There was no filing. There was no communication to Judge Kaye or to the district court that anything more needed to be done.
What, why did it take so long for the payment to be made?
Well, again, I wasn't the assistant at that time.
I'll take your understanding.
My understanding is similar to what Mr. Terris said in response to that question. He initially said that he wasn't sure, but then he said that there were these other issues that had to be worked out, and one of them was the purported tax consequences of the payment. There was the government was in conversations with Mr. Shapiro's office and Mr. Terris. And Mr. Terris and Mr. Shapiro were talking to each other outside of the presence of the government about indemnifying Ms. Sims for some purported tax consequences, and the government was waiting to see what was going to happen. And as the district court points out in her
memo, why does that not continue? Why does that process end?
Well, frankly, Your Honor, when I took over the case, I looked at the record that's before the court now, and it was the decision of my office in consultation with the EPA that we simply had to carry out the order of the court.
Well, can I ask about this? I've never seen the government so eager to give up its money. I mean, this is probably the first time where the government, against a claim by the person to whom it is owed, pays anyway. So
well,
I'm interested in what order of the court did you think you would be breaching if you didn't pay an attorney who no longer represented the plaintiff?
Well, I have
there an order?
I have several different responses to you, Your Honor. And first of all, there was a settlement agreement which resolved the case. That was the letter agreement in 1999.
But that letter agreement says nothing about the amount of fees or whom they are to be paid,
and
correct?
It says payment of fees.
Right.
Then when you look at the transcript that I was pointing the court to, Joint Appendix 61 to 65 or so, you understand that Mr. Shapiro submitted an amended fee petition that would include all of the counsel.
Work backwards for me. If I have $150,000 of the taxpayers' money burning in my hands, and I have two choices, I can hold on to it, earn interest for the other taxpayers, or I can pay it to somebody, and the person who brought the lawsuit says, I don't want it, the only thing that would make me pay it is if I was afraid I'd be in contempt of court for not doing it. show me the order that ordered you to pay that money, or that you inferred from it that you had to pay the money.
Again, I have two responses, Your Honor.
I only need one. Is there an order?
There were representations made to Judge Kaye which resulted in Judge Kaye denying the amended fee petition as moot. And those are representations the government takes seriously.
And was it a representation to pay to this prior lawyer? Is that the representation?
I believe that was the discussion. And again, as Judge Rogers pointed out, unfortunately, there is no transcript of that conversation.
So on that question, so we have two cases that seem to be exactly on point here. One is the Otira case, and the other is United States versus Mahoney, both of which say that when there is a disagreement about whether there's a settlement agreement or what's into it, and there's no document that resolves it, the judge is supposed to hold an evidentiary hearing on the subject. So it seems to me quite sensible under these circumstances where your view of what you had to pay depends on facts that are not in any record, that under those circumstances the thing for the court to do was to hold a hearing. But otherwise, I don't see any order that ordered you to pay to the former attorneys.
Well, the obligation in the 1999 agreement was to pay fees. There were representations made between counsel and to Judge Kaye about the amount, about the payment being made, which rendered the pending motion moot, and that resolved the proceedings in the district court.
But your representation is, and you're representing for the government, that you believe, based on your conversation with somebody not in the room today, that included in that agreement was payment to the former attorneys, right? Their representation before us is that agreement did not include payment to the former attorneys. So it seems to me this is the kind of thing that needs to get, we don't know one way or the other, nor did the district judge know, because there's nothing on the record about that.
Well, again, the district court did have a hearing about the enforceability of the settlement agreement.
Right.
And the district court, per Magistrate Judge Kaye, did have a hearing about the amended fee petition. And to that extent, there was a hearing about these issues.
But did it include the question of whether the money should be paid directly to somebody who is no longer an agent for the plaintiff in the case?
Well, I think that question is resolved, again, by Mr. Terrace's own statement at Joint Appendix 61 saying, Mr.
Well, I
Shapiro,
thought they weren't even challenging that.
I agree, Your Honor.
I thought he said he didn't care who the check was paid to,
and,
but I could be wrong.
I agree with you.
We'll ask him on rebuttal.
I agree. And I would also point out another thing, which is if you look at the letters, which are in the record, they're the attachment to the plaintiff below, the appellant's motion to the district court for declaratory relief. She is attached her letters and also my office's letters. If you look at my office's letters, we specifically tried to resolve this with Mr. Terrace. We said, look, if you want us to pay Ms. Sims directly, we'll do that. If you want us to pay you, we'll do that.
No, I don't have any dispute that you tried hard. They obviously were not yet ready because they are negotiating. They want to work out some other deal with their former lawyers. And the government is clearly acting in good faith here. You tried to find a resolution. But that doesn't mean you had to pay. And all they're saying is that they're seeking a declaration that they had no agreement that you had to pay that amount. At that point, that's the thing we don't know the answer to.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, and again, this is what we explained to the district court. The district court agreed with us, and the district court is the one at that point with the power over the settlement agreement and over the government. We felt that we had been ordered to make that payment, and that's
you'd
what
say
we
did. The district court agreed that was after you'd already paid, right? Not before you'd paid.
That's correct. The declaratory judgment motion was filed.
Again, I'm still uncertain about what happened. In other words, you get this case and take a look at it and decide what? That payment should be made?
That we had represented to Judge Kaye that payment would be made, and we better do that.
So there wasn't concern about the IRS issues?
First of all, Ms. Sims could have raised that and didn't in 1999 when she originally entered into the settlement agreement. And what Mr. Terrace was saying earlier, that this problem or issue had only arisen in 2004 with the Job Creation Act, but that act responded to a legal issue, which was Title VII plaintiffs were in the predicament or the position where if they didn't get a big compensatory damage award and they owed a lot of fees, they could be stuck for tax liability. That situation existed in 1999. Congress responded to that in 2004. Ms. Sims could have bargained
this. And it looks like from the record they were trying to do something so that they weren't harmed by the fact that the new act was not retroactive.
I agree with that, and again, the posture that we've
taken. It also looks like you got into the case and decided you weren't going to participate in that.
Well, my office does not render tax advice. We don't represent, in this case, the IRS. They are not the defendant. I cannot, and on behalf of my office, I cannot give tax advice to Ms. Sims. And like I said, it was not part of the agreement. It was never bargained for. It arose later.
The district court didn't rule on any of these things. The district court just ruled that there was no jurisdiction because the case had been closed and she didn't have continuing jurisdiction.
I read her opinion to have two parts. I think in the beginning part she said, look, the case...
If she ruled she had no jurisdiction and there is another part, that would be a very bad thing, right? That would be an advisory opinion. Do you think she ruled on the merits and that she had no jurisdiction?
I think she said...
I don't mean a very bad thing.
I understand.
Just as a matter of federal courts.
I would say the district court was being conservative and thorough in presenting to this panel and to the Court of Appeals a decision that's eminently reasonable because she says, look, I don't have jurisdiction. I told you before the case is closed. It was settled through a settlement agreement. But even to the extent that we look at the merits of the motion for declaratory judgment.
That sort of even if is the thing that was to set off gongs when somebody says, even if there is no jurisdiction, I'm going to rule on the merits.
Well, I think she's saying simply in the alternative.
No, I know. But in the Steel Company, the Supreme Court specifically told us we cannot do that. Same rule applies to the district court. Right?
I understand your point, and if you want to dismiss the case on the basis of jurisdiction, that is acceptable.
I agree with the district court.
I'm sorry?
She's just saving herself a remand. Yes.
And then the Supreme Court may someday disagree with us, but they don't want us to save them remands. Well, let me ask you, on the jurisdiction question, you really think there's an order that dismissed this case such that under Bailey we have no jurisdiction? Bailey, we said... According to the federal rules, there has to be a separate judgment that dismisses the case. I'm not seeing it. Can you show me where it is? I've got the docket report here. It starts JA 12, 13. Is there anything, any docket entry that says that the case is dismissed?
Not in the sense that you're asking. And my response is this. There was a settlement agreement. There was a dispute about whether the letter was a settlement agreement. That was brought to the district court. It was resolved. It was a settlement agreement. It was enforceable. That has the effect of just as a stipulation of dismissal of the parties under Rule 41. There is no need for the court to enter judgment. When a stipulation of dismissal is entered on the docket, that's it. The case is over. It's settled.
Where's the stipulation of dismissal entered on the docket?
Well, the court held a hearing.
Yeah, but you may be right. When there is a stipulation of dismissal entered on the docket, that's the end. But I don't see those words here.
Well,
so the court held a hearing, and said.
I understand Your Honor's point, and those words are not in the docket. At least I haven't seen them. What the court did was say there is an enforceable settlement agreement. That settlement agreement is in the docket of the case, at least through Ms. Sims' motion, if not through through the hearing. That the district court held, and that is sufficient to dismiss the case. There's no reason for the district court to enter judgment for a party because nobody won. The case was settled, and there's no reason for the government to move to dismiss, as Ms. Sims suggests, because, again, the case was settled.
When the government reaches a settlement, it usually doesn't wait for a court order to make the payment, does it?
No, and in fact, I've thought about this issue, not just separate and apart from this case, but this
just
issue.
Generally, it would be bad faith for the government to reach a settlement and then say, oh, well, you need to go to court and get an order.
That's exactly right. My view is that when the parties file a stipulation of dismissal on the record, that is the agreement. That dismisses the case, and the government's then obligations arise as to carry out the agreement.
And we have such stipulations.
Here we do.
Where is that again?
Well, it is the letter agreement that the district court. I mean, the posture is a little bit different than the usual case because Ms. Sims went to the district court and said, this letter's enforceable settlement agreement, the district court agreed. So you don't have it entered.
But the letter itself can't be. The letter doesn't have any amount for attorney's fees. So the case wasn't actually ended at that point, was it?
Well, the obligation to pay fees arises from that letter.
So everything that happened after the letter, there's a lot of things in the letter in this docket after that date. All of that's wrong. The court shouldn't have considered any of those things.
All of that had to do with the amount of the fees, as Judge Rogers pointed out earlier.
You can't have a proceeding continuing with respect to the amount of fees if the case has actually been dismissed. Do you think the case was actually dismissed even before even before Magistrate Kay ruled that the motion was moot?
I think that the case was the merits of the case had been resolved and the settlement agreement was enforceable. And I think that the only thing left for any judge at the district court level to do was to resolve the fee dispute, which it did in 2003. So
but we have many cases where judges think they've resolved the matter and don't file a separate judgment. Sometimes the government is the one that's stuck, and the government says, we don't have to start filing. Our clock hasn't run yet. Do you want us to take the position that whenever we interpret an oral statement by a judge on the bench as ending the government's case, even if the judge doesn't file a separate judgment, that your time is ticking?
No, I think this is a unique case, and I would note that I see my time is over, and I would just ask to address Judge Garland's point and the Bailey case, because I think it is important for this court's resolution. I think that Judge Garland's question is really asking, you know, how do we deal with Bailey? What does Bailey mean for this case? And I would just note that in Bailey, the issue was whether there was an enforceable settlement agreement. That issue here was resolved 7 years ago. And now the issue is different. It's teed up on Ms. Sims' motion for declaratory relief.
There was an enforceable agreement that the government was liable for fees. That's what was enforceable. And that's what the district court says.
Right. And then that was resolved in 2003. And that's the second part of my response about Bailey. The panel in Bailey says that a case becomes final, could become final, when the district court disengages itself. In other words, if there's no entry on the docket, but the district court has disengaged itself, surely that happened here in 2003. It did not, even if...
But disengages itself in a slightly different context is what we were talking about.
And the sentence in Bailey is, because the district court did not issue the appropriate order pursuant to Rule 58A dismissing the complaint, it continued to have jurisdiction.
Right.
That's the holding of Bailey.
And again, Bailey, as here, the situation is different. There, the issue was the enforceability of the agreement. There, both parties came to this court asking for a remand. That's not the posture of this case. And then there's also an important wrinkle here, and that is what the dispute that was specifically before the district court and that the district court resolved was a motion for declaratory relief. And I haven't seen anything in appellant's papers, and perhaps Mr. Terrace can address this, but I haven't seen any authority that says the district court has jurisdiction or can resolve such a motion in the posture of this case, and that an appeal would lie from that. The posture of the case is simply different from Bailey.
All right, thank you. We'll hear from appellant.
Your Honors, if there was a violation of a court order in this case by not in the method of payment, it was by the government in paying money to Mr. Shapiro. The letter agreements.
Wait a second. You said to me when I asked you specifically that you didn't object to who the check was made out to. Are you changing your answer on that?
Let me just in for the purposes of what we were interested in.
Yes
the
or
tax
no? Are you changing your answer?
Your Honor, if we'd worked out the tax consequences, the matter of who it went to would not have been critical. That is correct. But because of the tax.
How are you going to work out the tax consequences?
Well, we thought we had an agreement in principle about it, and then we were in effect.
What? To say the merits of the case had not been resolved before 2005?
We would try to do that, but also...
You think that was a true statement?
That it hadn't been resolved?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, the merits have been resolved in 99, and you're trying to get a letter agreement in 2005 that suggests otherwise. For purposes of the tax consequences.
It would have been a true statement because there were still open ends that had not been done. At the end of the enforcement, the judge said, specifically on the record, there were still more things to be worked out. So it was not a final determination. No. It was a determination that the settlement, that the letter agreement, to the extent that it dealt with anything, it was enforceable. It did not say that that was comprehensive on the case. And so, yes, I think that it had not been settled in totality before 2004, and it
but,
was,
but for
would
the
have
tax
been a true statement.
Suppose there were no tax consequence issues here.
Yes.
Wouldn't your client have wanted payment made shortly after the 2003 order was entered, as opposed to waiting?
The client years? Would have been indifferent to it because...
Indifferent? The client wouldn't have wanted the money paid?
It would have probably...
I mean, normally, this case is bizarre because normally you're not objecting to getting money from the government.
It's in bizarre in both directions here.
The money was going
first
to
time the government wants to pay early and the client doesn't want the money.
Only because of the... But, Your Honor, there had been no tax consequences. None of this would have occurred.
Did changing the tax consequences depend on recharacterizing whether there had been a settlement of the merits in 1999?
Does not recharacterize. It is exactly what occurred.
Does changing the tax consequences depend on the merits of the case not being final until 2004?
I've got to give you two answers, Your Honor. There are two ways we could have solved the problem. One was that we were covered by the 2004 statute. We were also negotiating with counsel to hold us harmless. In other words, that they would say if there was going to be tax consequences,
but one method,
we will recompense you.
Am I right that one method you were exploring
yes.
was to get an agreement that the case really hadn't been settled?
Correct.
Before 2004.
And we would seek the...
Even though, in fact, it had been settled.
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying to Your Honor is most of it had been settled, but that there were some open issues, and the district court specifically said there were open issues.
All right. You're just saying the case wasn't final because the attorney's fees had not been finally resolved.
That's true, but also right. some other issues were open. I want to make this other point because I think it's extremely important. The letter agreement, which was enforceable, district court said it was, required payment to the plaintiff. Specifically to
Ms. But I've asked you this multiple times now. You've just said you don't object to who the check was made out to.
Your Honor, we ultimately object to the payment in its entirety.
Okay.
Now,
he's qualified.
Now, the other point I'm making is that in the 2000...
So let me just say what Judge Roger just said, sotto voce. You're qualifying your prior response to Judge Kavanaugh.
Well, I thought
it does matter.
That's what I meant by my term.
Okay.
Yeah. The 2003 ruling by Judge Kay was not based on any discussion of the payment would actually be made to the plaintiff or to anybody else. That
standard
issue was not raised.
Standard practice, as you've said, for it to go to the attorney.
In my experience, that is true, yeah. But I do not want to represent to you that is always what occurs.
Wouldn't want payment normally being made directly to your clients?
Excuse me?
Payment in your cases is not normally made directly to the clients.
That is correct, but yeah. We have an order in this case, a specific order, that says that this payment was to be made to the client. If we're looking for an order that the government wants to go back to the enforcement of the letter agreement, is specific. The payment is to Ms. Sims. Now, when the 2003 order of Judge K comes up, there is, and this is in the record, the amended motion for attorney's fees, does not deal with this issue at all. And what I'm saying is it did not come up. It's not in the order, and I was on the phone.
Was that part of the February telephone conference?
That's what I'm saying to Your Honor. Okay. It did not come up. What came up was, have you got a settlement in the amount? Have you compromised in the amount? And that's what Judge Case said, and that is what the discussion was about.
All right. Anything further, counsel?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.